What does it feel like to be inside this undertaking? That's what RAIN is all about. It's the gift inside Pandora's box. RAIN, a meditation. 5 to 15 minutes. Start by taking a few breaths. When we work with emotions, which can get very strong, there's an important preliminary step of identifying some subtly comfortable or settling sensation, or simply seeing if you can tune into an underlying stillness somewhere. This is like a home base you can come back to. It might be the breath, or a peaceful feeling in the body, or a sound, or an image, even an external picture you can look at. Take a couple minutes to find this place and to meditate on it, noticing its qualities, getting familiar with it. This is a place we'll come back to over the course of the meditation. You can visit it anytime you need a break. Note it, if you like. Call it home or rest. The first step of RAIN, the R, is recognize. Can you recognize any emotions happening in your experience right now? Sadness, happiness, anger, frustration, curiosity, boredom, impatience, anxiety, any emotion. If so, note it. Sadness, boredom, whatever. A feeling may not even be obvious. Sometimes when we look, we realize that, actually, we've been carrying around a kind of background emotion with us all day. Maybe it's a hollow, hurt feeling in the throat, or a shaky excitement in the chest, or a band of tension in the neck and shoulders. There are many permutations of these, often expressed through some trackable body sensation in the face, throat, neck, chest, or belly. If you think there's some emotion happening, but you don't know exactly what it is, or even where it is, just note it as feel. If you happen to be emotionally neutral at the moment, you can try to deliberately evoke an emotion. You can bring to mind some idiotic YouTube video of a dude farting in a freezer bag and notice any feelings of hilarity or weary disappointment in humanity. Or you can think of a situation or a person that angers you, or saddens you, or fills you with well-being. Whatever is here, the first thing is to see it clearly. Our next step is A, accept. That means, whatever the emotional sensation, you let it be there. Instead of trying to ignore it or suppress it, which we often do, you open to the whole complicated feeling of it, with great tenderness and care. You're cultivating a feeling of self-compassion as you do this, which hopefully means you'll also naturally pace yourself and take it easy. This attitude provides a new way to experience these sensations, so the emotions behind them can start to get expressed and even metabolized. The neuroscience of this is fascinating. We're essentially integrating our emotions with our cognition, marrying what we feel with what we know. Acceptance may seem unassuming, but it is the most important move a human being can make. It has dozens of near synonyms described in different ways in every culture and tradition. Forgiveness, love, equanimity, maturity, being present. Acceptance is a radical act of coming into the world by letting go of what's in the way and welcoming exactly what's emerging. There can even be a bracing existential quality to this act. It's as though when we accept every part of this moment, we synchronize with it. Acceptance isn't easy when we're inside a challenging emotion like anger or fear or sadness. But the alternative is either grabbing on, which can make the emotion more painful when it leaves, or pushing away, which may work in the short term, but ultimately amplifies and drags the emotion out. The expression is, what you resist persists. It's like trying to win a wrestling match with a giant blob of melted toffee. The harder you push, the more entangled you get. Sometimes you don't even realize you're subtly fighting with a feeling or sensation. Your body might be tense, like you're braced in some way against a thought or a feeling or a sound. It's a kind of friction that we can sometimes detect if we look. If you realize that you actually don't want to accept a particular emotion, then the true kung fu move is to zoom out the camera and accept your aversion. It's always the same move, only the scale changes. Which brings us to the I of RAIN, investigation. Investigation is expanding and deepening the volume of what we're accepting. It's getting interested in whatever we're feeling and exploring it at a pace that works for us. There's a learning curve here around how to do this skillfully. We want to be curious and aware of our emotions without feeding them. This is so important. Some of our chains of emotional reactions are on a hair trigger. Guilt leads to critical thoughts, which lead to sadness and negative images of yourself and sudden catastrophizing about the future. And before you know it, you're curled into a ball in the basement under an old tarp, inconsolable and covered in petrified mouse droppings. We can go from zero to tilt very quickly. When this happens, we're no longer mindful. We've almost always lost our ability to keep track of what's going on. We're working with emotional feedback loops that want to complete their circuits. It's like the energy in them can't quite discharge, so the pattern keeps playing out again and again. Every time it plays out, it gets more entrenched. How to work with it then? With a light touch. The key is to observe our emotions in the most relaxed possible way. Friendly, but also objective. It's more important here to be relaxed in our attitude than to see every part of an emotion clearly. We let the sensation come to us. We let it show itself. We're never in a hurry. The clarity will emerge from the equanimity, less so the other way around. This kind of openness is the ideal medium in which to absorb an emotion's momentum. It is exactly in this moment that change can happen. When you see and open yourself to a feeling, particularly one that comes around again and again, then it's less likely to escalate or chain forward. The mindfulness somehow takes the wind out of its sails. If you do this enough times, you create a new and healthier habit. The entire emotional behavioral response can be rerouted. It's a way of slowly and patiently taking responsibility for ourselves.
Jeff, what's the move if we're doing this meditation and a strong emotion spikes up and gets super intense and we find ourselves en route to that tarp with the petrified mouse droppings?
There are a few options. One, you can deliberately zoom in on one small part of the emotional sensation, the very center of it maybe, or one of its edges. You breathe out and keep the body relaxed as you lightly track this one small part, noticing how the sensations, the throbbing or tingling or aching or tension, either move and change or stay the same. When we isolate one part of the emotional sensation, it becomes more manageable. And by staying clear and mindful, we can prevent the emotion from amplifying into what can become an overwhelming chain reaction. So it still might surge, but if we stay with it in a mindful way, the wave can also quickly recede, leaving us feeling lighter and calmer. Another good strategy is to swing back to the home base sensation we identified at the start. Everyone should do this anyway, as a matter of course, throughout the meditation. It's part of working smart. Every few minutes, practice shifting your attention to the comparative comfort of this other place, your breath, an image or sound, or some peaceful grounding quality in the body. Meditate here for a while. Or do a compassion practice. That's also a good option. This is how we pace ourselves. We swing into a feeling, lightly observe it for a while, then we swing back to home base, relax there, then we return to survey the activation for a little while longer. That's the process, moving at a rhythm that works for us, a bit deeper with each swing of the pendulum. Of course, it's also important to say that at any time, you can just stop meditating and go for a walk or talk it out with a friend. There are many ways to work with our emotions. The fourth and final step of RAIN, the N, is non-identification. Non-identification is less an action than an attitude, the attitude of not taking your emotions personally. However counterintuitive it may sound, it's something to try, to explore. How does it change your experience to note anger is happening, the way you might note a thunderstorm is happening? Emotions are the atmospheric conditions of this human moment, part of the natural flow of things, a product of untold causes and conditions that roll out quite on their own. So give yourself a break. You don't have to constantly judge yourself for feeling a particular way. It's okay. We're all part of this much bigger process. And guess what? When we stop compulsively claiming every passing emotion and thought as I, me, mine, then something beautiful may happen. We feel more connected to everything and everyone else. Very slowly, we start to get over ourselves. Non-identification is actually implicit in Rain's previous two steps. It's a deeper kind of allowing. If you want to move, try lightly noting each sensation as not me, or even better, be free. We're liberating the butterfly conservatory over here. Free all the little sensations. Not me. Be free. Let all experiences come and go. What's happening now will be different soon enough, and what a privilege it is to be here at all. Sub specie aeternitatis, the view from eternity. And that's the practice. Make sure to finish back at your home base, at the breath or some sound or sensation that feels comfortable for you. Before you open your eyes, take a few minutes to relax, maybe even lie down. Let the work integrate. Cheat sheet. 1. Close your eyes and first find home base, some sensation that feels comforting. Maybe it's the breath, or a relaxed place in your body, or a picture in front of you. 2. Recognize. Ask yourself, are there any emotions happening? If so, note them. Anger, sadness, exuberance. If you can't find the exact name for what you're experiencing, note it as feel. 3. Accept. Open to the feeling and let the sensation do exactly what it wants to do. See if you can find a quality of caring and friendliness for this emotion that just wants to express itself. 4. Investigate. Now we get curious about our emotion, about where it's happening and what it's doing. Is it centered around a particular part of your body? Is the feeling staying the same or is it changing? See if you can lightly follow the sensation, like you're a field naturalist. If the emotion starts to get too intense, you have a couple options. One is you can try to zoom in on one small part of it and notice just that, which makes things more manageable. Or you can swing your attention back to your comfortable place, noting home or rest. 5. Non-identification. Can you let the emotional feeling do its thing without taking it personally? Try to see your emotions like you see the weather, not something to judge yourself for, but rather part of the natural atmospheric conditions of the moment. This is a deeper form of allowing. After you've let this happen for a while, go back to the breath or to your home or rest sensation. Before you open your eyes, take a few minutes to relax and do nothing.
Hey, Jeff, a few questions on Rain. I want to home in on the accept piece, letter A, because it seems really central here, and yet also subtle. How do you know if you're really accepting something?
Usually the emotion gets less intense, although not always. Feelings have their own arc and lifespan. There can also be dramatic experiences in which you get a noticeable release. It's a bit like when you suddenly realize you've been holding your breath or tensing some part of your body, and you let out this long exhale and everything relaxes and you're like, man, why didn't I let go of that sooner? Or you finally give someone a piece of your mind and afterwards you feel this huge weight come off your shoulders. It's cathartic. In fact, catharsis is another word for this dynamic. The more we accept, the more the energy that was bound up in our previous gripping or aversion or fixation gets freed up. As a result, we often feel calmer and lighter and generally more sane. And of course, when we let go, we also make space for new things to come in. So each release is also an update.
I know you're super interested in the idea of updating the mind like we do with a software program, except the total disappearance of a pattern only rarely happens, right? How much can chronic feelings of anxiousness or sadness or anger really change? Isn't meditation more about mitigating our suffering rather than resolving it altogether?
I think it's both. One way to think about it is to ask, what's the relationship between in-the-moment experiences of catharsis, which are pretty common, and long-term change and transformation? It's the million-dollar question. There's definitely a relationship. I've had meditators tell me about seeing and releasing some deep pattern in the moment, and they say it's gone for good, poof, which is completely bonkers if it's true and has serious implications for how we think about learning and behavior change. I think it's one of the most important things meditation has to share with neuroscience. But my sense is that these kinds of sudden transformations are pretty rare. And actually, contemplatives say this too. It's more about gradual change. Most practitioners I've spoken to say the patterns come back, just a little less insistently each time. This has been my personal experience. I'll see this stuff again and again, and the more I do, the less it owns me. Eventually, I've had emotional patterns get so worked through, it's like they become transparent. Still there, but hardly influential. But then, other times, this thing I thought I'd dealt with comes back and bites me in the ass 10 years later, especially if I'm stressed. It's worth mentioning here that the permanent disappearance of all patterns of reactivity is one of the central claims of Buddhism. They say it can be done. Although most of the senior teachers I know say it's more like you're always halving the distance to zero, but never quite getting there.
As our encounter with the folks from AIT was wrapping up, we took some group pictures in front of the bus, and then the 10% happier team clambered aboard, did our count off, and set off for our next destination. Amazingly, we were on schedule. It wasn't luck or divine intervention, it was Ben, who was now officially running this road show. He had initially resisted the assignment, but now that he was actually in the role, he loved it. This didn't surprise me at all. Ben really enjoys bossing people around. A more polite way of saying that would be he's a natural leader. I was well acquainted with the benevolent dictatorship of Ben Rubin. Despite being nearly 10 years my junior, he had essentially been running significant chunks of my life for quite a while as the CEO of our 10% Happier Meditation Enterprise. As I do with everyone I like, I mock Ben mercilessly. He dresses in what might charitably be called geek chic. His hair reminds me of that scene from the movie Knocked Up, where Katherine Heigl asks Seth Rogen whether he uses product in his unruly mop of curls, and he replies, "No, that's I use Jew, it's called." Ben toggles back and forth between an all-business, C-3PO-like chief executive, and when he's letting his figurative hair down, a florid goofball who insists on telling jokes that only he finds funny. In spite of his lack of comedic chops, Ben has become one of my closest and most trusted advisors. He's like a younger version of me, except more disciplined, more thoughtful, and way better at math. Among our shared interests, making good-natured fun of Jeff when he goes off on his mythopoetic jags, waving his arms wildly like he's conducting the universe or Rolfing reality. Among our shared aversions, pretty much everything touchy-feely. In fact, Ben, even though he too is a dedicated meditator, has this particular allergy even worse than I do. So you can imagine how excited he was when Jeff, on board the bus, proposed a group discussion about our go-to emotional patterns and how meditation could help. It was a voluntary opening of Pandora's box. We were in our usual configuration. Jeff and I were seated at the small dining table in the front cabin, with Ben, Carly, and several others arrayed on the bench across from us. "So maybe I'll just start," said Jeff. "If indeed Ben has any emotions, they may even emerge." "Unlikely," said Ben, smirking. Jeff then walked us through an account of some of what he had excavated when he turned the meditative microscope on deeper and deeper levels of his own psyche. Early on in his practice, he noticed a go-faster pattern that was, he said, the secret life of my ADD, a stream of images of places I'd rather be and things I'd rather be doing, along with a continuous agitated buzzing through the core of my body. This chronic dissatisfaction caused him to push for ever more stimulation, which in turn activated him more and satisfied him less, until eventually he'd crash, only to repeat the cycle again. Meditation helped him back off and observe this process without indulging it. The practice also enabled him to see deeper emotional elements, including one of the sources of his sharpest pain. He said, I learned that as a consequence of feeling like I don't belong, in his life, in his family, anywhere, I had a lot of judgments about that, which I internalized about not being good enough. I could see way down this part of me that would just put the knife into myself. That feeling of insufficiency, he said, had created mindless behavioral patterns. There's one that's about being compulsively super nice and wanting to help everybody all the time. It's this acting out of my own insecurity that is just so ingrained. And another one is anger that I have this embarrassing insecurity in the first place. As moved as I was by Jeff's honesty, when it was my turn to speak, I felt a surge of discomfort. Hearing my friend hold forth in such a raw manner reminded me that I had thus far been spared so much of the difficulty that other people have had to endure. The truth is, I was born on third base, the recipient of an incalculable amount of unearned privilege. I had a kind of idyllic childhood, I said. I have two really loving parents who never got divorced, and I was totally supported. They were hippies, and there was a lot of lovey-dovey stuff, so I think the result was a spoiled kid. Yes, I had endured the trifecta of panic, anxiety, and depression, but my struggles were rarely rooted in personal trauma, and in fact were sometimes self-manufactured. And yes, through my years of meditation, I had faced some difficult interior phenomena, including anger, impatience, boredom, and fear, but truthfully, none of it felt that heavy. Maybe this meant I was a terrible meditator, or maybe there simply wasn't a lot of Mahler music playing in the backdrop of my psyche. I found it embarrassing that so much of my internal bandwidth was occupied by material that was, relatively speaking, petty and selfish. Even as we sat there on the bus, most of my thoughts were swirling around whether all the greasy road food we were eating was going to require me to wear Spanx, and whether my ongoing email negotiations with the musician Moby, who was supposed to lead a sound meditation at our culminating event in L.A., would prove successful. This discussion tapped right into my ongoing storyline about having some sort of internal frigidity. I definitely have stuff I don't want to face, I offered to the group, adding that I suspected it was around capacity for compassion and stuff like that, which I think is a source of shame for me. Intellectually, I knew I wasn't a sociopath, and yet I still struggled with this story about myself. I was not alone. Ben weighed in, explaining that, like me, he struggled with feelings of selfishness. I feel like I get locked. Instead of feeling compassion for all of those people who need help, I just squish it down and put it in a box because if I feel the compassion for them, then I might have to help, and that would hurt me. It would hurt him, he said, because the voice in his head was saying, I can't help. I don't have the time. I don't have the energy. I don't have the money. I don't have the whatever. Sitting there, I felt empathy and compassion for Ben's perceived lack of empathy and compassion. I knew from prolonged personal exposure to him that he was actually extremely helpful, and also that he viewed leadership as a source of service. His words also helped me realize that I had actually made real progress since I was his age. Despite the sometimes selfish nature of my inner dialogue, having a child had opened up heretofore unseen reservoirs of feeling. Moreover, through meditation, I had come to enjoy helping others because mindfulness had revealed how good it can feel to be nice. As a tiny example of this, bring to mind how pleasant it can feel when you do something as simple as holding open a door for someone. Meditation had shown me how scalable this behavior is. I called it the self-interested case for not being a dick. When we catch ourselves thinking or acting in unkind or ungenerous ways, it can produce a running dialogue of second arrow self-reproach. Such was the case for Ben. As he said, there's the layer of shame on top of that. That's like, oh, you're a shitty person. What a shitty person. You can't be bothered to help or even feel compassion when you can't help. You're kind of a broken human. Jeff said, when you're in a pattern, it feels like fate. He had seen it play out in his own life. He told us he would occasionally get into a mood where my life is completely fucked and everything is screwed up. I don't know what I'm doing. But that is when his years of meditation practice would kick in. Anytime I go into that space now, which I still do, I always have a little bit of perspective around it. I can always say, oh yeah, I've been here before. That is the kind of invaluable perspective we're training in this practice, using RAIN and other meditations to boost our inner radar. We can learn to track our emotional storms before they make landfall. As the bus drove west from New Mexico into Arizona, passing fantastic rock formations that looked like gigantic Martian versions of the Play-Doh sculptures my son makes, I recalled something Jeff had said during our visit to AIT. When confronted with difficult emotions or distractions, he said, the first move is to say, all right, welcome to the party. Welcome to the party. This seemed like the perfect way to introduce equanimity when confronted with emotions we don't want to face. Moreover, it struck me as something that might help me in my own practice. Perhaps welcome to the party was the antidote to my seemingly intractable habit of beating myself up every time I got distracted. What if, I asked Jeff, at that moment when you wake up and you're having judgment about everything, you use that as a mantra right there? Jeff was jazzed. There are few things MacGyver loves more than minting new meditations. Why don't we do a welcome to the party meditation? He exclaimed. Here it is.
Welcome to the party, a meditation. 5 to 15 minutes. Start in the usual way. Couple of deep breaths, relaxing on the exhale. Make a decision here at the start not to get uptight about anything. That's the entire principle of this meditation. No secret biases or preferences. Everything that rises is welcome, including your most neurotic judgments and unholy feelings and seething resentments. All perfect. So happy to see you. Welcome to the party of my direct experience. Would you care for an aperitif like that? If you're a breath person, start there to get settled, zeroing in on the soft feeling of it. Or choose another body sensation. Heart, belly, bum, hands. Note it if you like. Feel. Or if you're working with the breath, in and out. Enjoying the full feeling. Committed to this direction in our experience. Mind wanders, bring it back. And here's the fun part. There's one more note. Welcome to the party. Really say this in your head. Whenever you're getting pulled into a thought or you get distracted by something and you notice it, say, welcome to the party. Make it your mantra. Welcome the insistent thought. Welcome the annoying sensation. Welcome the distracting sound. Then return to noticing the breath. There are no enemies in this meditation. There are no problems, only new things to notice and welcome. And, as usual, it's okay to fake it. Welcome your fakery. Welcome your suspicion. Welcome the smell of fried chicken floating in from the neighborhood. Explore how this attitude affects the tone of your meditation. Try this for a while. If your mind wanders, welcome the fact that your mind wandered and go back to the breath. There's no traction here for feeling bad. After you've done this a while, if you like, try experimenting with a wider expanse of mindfulness. To do this, let go of your focal attention on the breath or body and send your awareness out to include any sounds coming and going, and also the wider sense of space in the room, the volume of air above and behind and around you. Note sounds, if you like. Note space. Let your mind get big and soft. Welcome your big, soft mind to the party. If you find this open focus challenging to maintain, you can return to the breath at any time. But the idea is to explore what happens when you expand the stance of your welcoming. Now there really is no such thing as a distraction. All sounds and sensations are welcome. all of it rising and falling within the broad space of your awareness. "Welcome to the party," you say to anything you happen to notice, and then you kick back, aware of sounds, aware of space, maybe aware of the body and the breath and whatever else, aware of it all, no limits. When you're feeling ready, come back to the body, to the breath, and the feeling of contact with the ground, enjoying the body, its solidity and presence, recombobulating. Rest here for a minute or two, and then slowly open your eyes. Cheat sheet. 1. Choose an anchor for your attention. Breath, belly, bum, hands, something you already know works for you. Use a note if it helps. In, out. Feel. 2. Whenever you get distracted, notice this has happened, and then good-naturedly note, "Welcome to the party." Notice it with welcoming amusement, and then return to your anchor, letting the distraction fade or stay in the background or do whatever it wants. You are a generous party host. 3. After 5 or 10 minutes, experiment with a wider field of mindfulness. So let go of focal attention on the breath and expand to include the sense of sounds and space around you. Note sounds. Note space. Note welcome to the party for all of it. If you don't like this broader stance, you can always return to your original focus. 4. At the end, bring your full attention back into the body, and then let yourself rest and do nothing for a couple minutes before opening your eyes.
"That was a great meditation," I said as Jeff wrapped up. To be clear, it wasn't magic. Big Eddie, that's what we called our driver, to distinguish him from regular Eddie, our director, was blasting the radio up front, and it was continually annoying me. I would try to greet both the noise and my reaction to it with a hearty, "Welcome to the party." It didn't work every time, but it was comforting to hear Jeff say that it didn't have to. This was a training. As Jeff often said, fake it until you make it. In those tiny little moments where the mantra did work, where I was being less uptight about my less-than-perfect concentration, I got a glimpse of how powerful this practice could be, how it could make my meditation less fraught and perhaps even transform my relationship with my own emotions. Yeah. Isn't all this getting in touch with your feeling stuff, not to mention the maudlin girl interrupted style group therapy, just going to turn you into a navel-gazing softie? Maybe Colbert was right about the utility of stuffing it all down. At our next stop, we were about to see if meditation could survive in one of the most difficult and dangerous jobs imaginable. Chapter 7. If I get too happy, I'll lose my edge. The first time I was in the back of a police car, I was 14 years old, and the 5-0 had nabbed me and my fellow brain trust wastrels for allegedly vandalizing a train station. I vastly preferred the ride Jeff and I took late on day 9 of our road trip when we hopped, voluntarily, into the back of a police SUV piloted by Sergeant Raj Johnson, a supervising officer on the midnight patrol in Tempe, Arizona. Tempe is just outside of Phoenix, with a population of about 165,000 that soars to 265,000 when the local college, Arizona State University, is in session. Raj, as he insisted we call him, is a sturdy former college football player with a shaven head and meticulously courteous manner. I had a hard time imagining him in his former life working undercover in narcotics with dreadlocks down to his shoulders. As we sped down the freeway, Raj regaled us with stories from his SWAT days and spoke openly about the strains of the job. He said, "It can be very stressful to come out here and know that you can go to a call and you could get injured, or you might have to use force that could injure somebody or take their life." He talked of seeing horrific car crashes, acts of domestic violence, and suicides. He mentioned the rising antagonism toward the police and a troubling uptick in ambush attacks on officers. And he told us how he had recently come close to discharging his weapon for the first time when confronted by a man high on meth who kept reaching for his waistband as if he had a weapon, all the while shouting, "Shoot me." "I thought my job was stressful," I said. Yeah, but the other side of the coin is, man, I love this job. Do you know what I mean? It's awesome to go to work with people who think like you and believe in the same mission, where you truly want to protect, you want to serve. As if to accentuate the perilous nature of his work, a call came over the radio indicating a pursuit in progress. Raj told us, "Sounds like there's a unit trying to stop a car, or a car is fleeing from them." He pulled a U-turn and started heading quickly in that direction. I could feel a little surge of adrenaline, an echo of what I used to experience when things got hot while I was on patrol in war zones. I was curious to know whether Raj felt it too. I asked, "I wonder, is a part of you also a little excited?" "Oh, absolutely. This is what they train for," he said. "It's exciting to go get some bad guys." When we arrived, it seemed like every police officer in Tempe was there, lights blazing. The cops on the scene reported that a DUI suspect had initially refused to stop. When he finally pulled over, he fought with the responding officers, who proceeded to tase him. Back in his SUV, Raj told us that when it came to handling the psychological ramifications of their work, police officers traditionally didn't have many options. He listed the most popular coping mechanisms: drinks, stuffing it down, or talking to your buddy about it. I asked, "Do you think on the force meditation is considered socially acceptable, or would people make fun of you a little bit?" He said, "You can be honest." "You know," he said, looking at me and Jeff a little sheepishly in the rearview mirror, "I think people are going to make fun of you a little bit." As he made clear, however, the concern went well beyond the "people might think I'm weird" obstacle. For police officers, the most pressing fear was that meditation might be downright dangerous. Raj came right out and said it. He worried meditation would make him soft. "You have to be on your game every day," he said. Faced with the demands of a high-stakes job that required tough, split-second decisions, what he needed most was speed and strength, both mental and physical. His question about meditation was, "Will it slow me down?" The lose-my-edge fear is one with which I have struggled mightily. Before I started meditating, I assumed the practice would hinder my ability to compete in the sometimes cutthroat world of TV news, and also that I might be required to wear my wife's yoga pants to the office. I have come to firmly believe that applied correctly, mindfulness enhances rather than erodes your edge. Increased focus helps me get more work done in less time. Decreased emotional reactivity allows me to stay calm during heated meetings. Having compassion for colleagues can lead to more allies, which, in an intensely collaborative atmosphere like ABC News, is incalculably valuable. Of course, having positive relationships with your coworkers happens to feel good for its own sake. Full disclosure, if you ask anybody who knows me, they will tell you I retain the propensity to be a multitasking, Twitter-checking, temper-losing dummy. Not for the last time, I will remind you that this is a game of gradual improvement. Even though meditation has taken off in all sorts of hard-charging, high-profile professions, from law enforcement to athletics to entertainment, I still encounter people who fear the practice will render them ineffective. Not long ago, I was invited to do an interview at the last place on earth I thought I'd ever talk about meditation, Fox News. It was a radio segment with an amicable anchorman named Brian Kilmeade, who posed a question along the lines of, "If I get too happy, won't I end up like Rocky from Rocky III? I hadn't seen that movie since I was a kid, so I went back and watched it. The film opens with a montage of the boxer, fresh off winning the championship, signing autographs, shooting TV commercials, and gamboling around his mansion with his wife and son. These scenes are intercut with images of a vaguely psychopathic-looking Clubber Lang, played by Mr. T, training hard and drubbing his opponents. By the second round of their eventual encounter in the ring, Rocky is on the mat, bleeding and unconscious. Message received. My new friend from Fox was worried that meditation would leave him vulnerable to leaner, hungrier opponents. But this conflates happiness with complacency, Just because you meditate does not mean you have to abandon stress and lazily rest on your laurels. I still experience plenty of internal churn. Why doesn't our app have more downloads? Why is Eckhart Tolle selling more books than me? Why is my son refusing to brush his teeth, and will he eventually look like he has meth mouth? My meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, once gave me the single best piece of advice I've ever received when it comes to the management of worry. When, for the 87th time, you find yourself chewing over, say, an impending deadline or your rival's promotion, maybe ask yourself one simple question. Is this useful? I employed this mantra quite often on our road trip whenever I found myself carried away by anxious thoughts. Why isn't Moby answering my emails? Is my next book going to be a classic case of the sophomore slump? Will it end up like that second critically panned Strokes record? I actually like that record. Meet Me in the Bathroom is my jam. Whoa, dude. At some point, maybe after I had stress-eaten a bag of pretzels, the mindfulness would kick in. Is this worrying useful? Probably not. Then I'd go back to listening to whatever interesting thing Jeff happened to be saying at the moment. The "Is this useful?" mantra has not only helped me waste less energy on internally generated distress, but has also allowed me to clear up bandwidth for new and different kinds of thoughts. For example, I am in closer touch with my more positive professional motivations, such as wanting to work on incredible stories with cool collaborators, as well as my gratitude for what I already have. There's an expression I frequently call to mind: these are the good old days. I used to spend the final moments before drifting off to sleep mulling over for the umpteenth time all of my current problems. Now I perform a somewhat corny ritual where I list everything I'm grateful for, including my wife, my son, and my job. The litany gets so long that sometimes I nod off before I come to the end. Turning down the volume on my unproductive mental nattering has given me the space to reckon with an indisputable fact. I am not fully in control. None of us is. We inhabit a chaotic universe. I try to adhere to the concept of non-attachment to results. It's great to work your tail off in service of a goal, but best to never forget that the end result is often dependent on much larger, often impersonal, causes and conditions. If you keep that in mind when your grand plans are subject to force majeure, it can drastically increase your resilience. In this way, meditation leads to edge without as much edginess. Mindfulness has helped me to see more clearly what really matters, which has made me less focused on advancement for its own sake. Fair warning, it is possible that increased self-awareness may lead you to conclude that some career goals you'd been rabidly pursuing may not actually provide true satisfaction, which may in turn lead you to pursue new and different goals. To me, however, that's not losing your edge, it's losing your delusions. Don't worry, though, if being heedlessly acquisitive genuinely makes you happy, meditation probably won't stand in the way. Nor, for that matter, do I think it will stand in the way of your creativity. People whose livelihoods depend upon being creative often tell me they fear increased happiness could come at a cost. There is a widely held belief, fed by tales of such miserable masters as Beethoven and Van Gogh, that you need to suffer for your art. I'm struck by the paradox that people come to meditation with two irretrievably irreconcilable fears. On the one hand, there's the fear of opening up a Pandora's box of enfeebling emotions. On the other, the fear that meditation will lead to some sort of bovine neutrality or blissed out blankness. In my experience, though, it works like this. Meditation simultaneously puts you in closer touch with your emotions while making you less of their marionette. Believe me, I'd love it if the practice miraculously erased all of my neuroses. Instead, I think it allows for greater intimacy with the pain and poignancy of life while providing the wherewithal not to drown in it. When we interviewed the singer Josh Groban back on day one of the road trip, he asked about the interaction between meditation and creativity. Jeff's response was, "If you're just crowding your head with the violence of your own anxious and neurotic preoccupations, How are you ever going to mine a deeply fertile experience? You're blocking it. Josh seemed to resonate with this concept of accessing the muse. Honestly, he said, some of the times when you feel like you've written the best thing, you say, well, I didn't write it. I was quiet and it came. Or as one of my favorite rappers, Schoolboy Q, once rhymed, metaphor. How I come up with it, I don't fucking know. While I do not consider myself an artist, my rapping and beatbox skills haven't advanced much since seventh grade, I have found that being less tied up in knots of fruitless worry gives me better access to good ideas wherever it is they come from. It has helped me immeasurably with extemporizing in live situations, a big part of my job as a morning news anchor and traveling speech giver. The most vivid example of this may be my aforementioned visit to the Colbert Report. I was more nervous about this appearance than any I'd ever done in my TV career. The idea of discussing my personal failings and my belief in the power of meditation with a fictional cable news bloviator was unsettling, to say the least. Colbert is one of the most quick-witted and fearsomely intelligent comics of our age, and his whole job in this role, before he went to CBS where he appears as himself, was to mercilessly play his guests for laughs. Before the show, the producers would take the guests aside and advise them not to try to be funny. Just play the straight man, they would say. Colbert himself would pop into the green room and deliver a rapid-fire, rote speech about how his character is a buffoon who will mock everything you hold dear. When he delivered that speech to me, I could feel the blood drain from my face. Moments later, I found myself in the surreal situation of being seated across from one of my pop culture heroes on a set of a show I had so often enjoyed from the comfort of my couch. My strategy was simple. Fall back on my meditation training. Drop all of my plans. Deliver no canned lines. Just be in the moment and respond to whatever happens. A few minutes into the interview, we got to the issue of drugs. Were you like a club kid on ecstasy? What were you doing? Did you have a pacifier in your mouth and glow sticks? He said, waving his hands like a raver. This was exactly the moment I had feared. I could hear the rising roar of the laughing crowd. I felt like I was in a Roman Colosseum and I was the gladiator about to get nixed. I have no memory of saying the following, but seemingly out of nowhere, I replied, "You're making me realize I did it wrong." Colbert paused, leaned back in his chair, and said, "Okay, that was good. Thank you, meditation, for enabling what was one of the most validating moments of my public life. I really am sure the conversation would have gone down differently had I not been able to let go, listen, and trust the moment." This is a whole different kind of edge, one that is available to anyone, whether or not you've built a career as a talking head. And it applies well past the workplace, enabling more spontaneous, authentic interactions in all aspects of your life. If you're a cop in Tempe, Arizona, however, your needs are significantly more urgent than the ability to ad-lib on camera, write a catchy song, or navigate office politics. When I make a mistake on air, it's embarrassing. When Raj or his colleagues lose their edge, people could get hurt or die. The day after our ride-along with Raj, Jeff and I went to visit his boss, the city's new police chief, Sylvia Moyer, who had made it her mission to introduce meditation to her officers. Latterly of El Cerrito, California, she'd been in Tempe for about a year. She combined no-cal earthiness with the crisp, authoritative demeanor of someone who had spent decades in criminal justice. Sitting in her large, light-filled, impeccably neat office decorated with both law enforcement memorabilia and tasteful throw pillows, she said her job required a tricky balance. "Dan," she told me, "try being a woman in police work. There's a lot of risk of not looking hardcore." Chief Moyer had initially written off meditation as a crunchy granola thing, but the science convinced her mindfulness could help her cops be more effective on the street and more resilient in the face of a torrent of stressors. Indeed, despite Raj's fear that meditation might slow him down, studies of people with dangerous jobs, including soldiers, firefighters, and police officers, have shown that meditation produces such benefits as improved working memory, reduced release of the stress hormone cortisol, and quicker recovery times after high-pressure incidents. But the PR problem remained real. The chief described the usual pushback from fellow officers. They're like, what are you talking about? This is going to make you lose your edge. You're going to be soft. What about the tactical necessity of the job? You have to make split-second decisions and be tactically sound. She argued, the opposite is true. I offer that it makes us more tactically sound, she said. The chief's argument appeared to be having an impact. When Jeff and I sat down separately with a group of eight of her officers, many of them were either open to the idea of meditation or were already practicing. We were situated around an empty square of tables in a conference room at police headquarters. Sergeant Rich Montaton, a former Marine, was the first to speak up. With his close-cropped blonde hair, black golf shirt, and tattooed biceps, he had what the writer Emily Nussbaum once called vinegar charisma. Sergeant Montaton had been on the force for 18 years. In his current role as the officer in charge of skills training for the department, it was his job to execute the new chief's meditation agenda. He acknowledged the stigma around meditation, but argued that members of the force were already practicing a form of it nearly every day, breathing exercises that officers would perform while en route to potentially dangerous calls or in the middle of tense confrontations. Deep breathing can mitigate the impact of adrenaline on fine motor skills and information processing. In fact, this is what Raj had told us he had done when confronted with that suspect who was high on drugs and demanding to be shot. The department called this exercise combat breathing. Sergeant Montaton noted dryly, "Now you're on board because I called it combat, right? I painted it black. It's tactical. You'll buy it." What emerged from the group discussion was that officers were craving the ability to build on combat breathing. Specifically, what they were seeking was the ability to reset, both during and after stressful events. One of the biggest challenges of police work is not to take the anxiety and anger from your previous call into the next one. The men and women in the room with us saw this ability to reset as a way to sharpen their edge while out on the street. This notion was nicely summed up by Officer Jake Schmidt, a newbie on the SWAT team who looked so young that everyone called him K through 8. He said, you go to a call, there's shots fired, and you leave that call, and the next one usually, you're going to someone with a barking dog. The citizen's really upset, and you're kind of like, really? You're upset? I just went to someone who just got shot. You just kind of got to hit that reset button. Equally as important, he said, was to not carry the disquiet of the day back into your personal life. Jake had a newborn and a toddler at home. He said, I want to be a good father to them and also be a good husband to my wife. So I think doing this kind of puts me in the present and not so caught up in replaying the day or worrying about tomorrow. Jeff was nodding vigorously. He said, you start to see how you're always bringing stuff into these situations. You're bringing your aggression, you're bringing your fear. But the smart move, Jeff explained, is to mindfully let it all be there without fighting it. He told the cops, instead of white-knuckling it through your experience, you're actually opening to the experience, and that's what allows you to reset. There were several questions in the room about how best to apply this skill in real time. Jeff had, at the ready, another simple but game-changing acronym, SURF, S-U-R-F, stop, understand, relax, freedom. Actually, he got this one from me. I came up with it. I think of it as a free-range version of RAIN. You can use this as a way to bring mindfulness into moments when you're fighting the urge to lose your temper, send an impolitic email, or eat a fistful of French fries. Here's Jeff.
Psychologists use a version of this meditation to help people through their addictions, including our technology addictions. The idea should be a familiar one by now. The faster we are at noticing our urges, the less likely we'll be to helplessly act on them, and the more quickly they'll pass, thus allowing us to reset. It is extremely hard to reset fully. As with everything about mind, body, and behavior, we're talking about a continuum. You can get better and better at disembedding from your urges and not acting on them, but we're still going to miss some of them and catch others late. And even with the ones we do catch, the feeling of wanting to act on them can linger for a long while, sometimes causing us to act out all over again as soon as we lose mindfulness. All of which is fine. 40% better, 20% better, even 10% better, that's still better. As someone with lifelong impulse control issues, I can definitely say that meditation has reduced my ratio of high-risk behaviors, to say nothing of the blurting out stupid shit at dinner parties ratio. Obviously, there's good automaticity and bad automaticity. You want to be able to trust your body's training and knowing. So it's important to make a distinction between the urges we want to immediately act on and the ones we don't. Like if we're about to get run over by a bus, we want to act on the urge to move and not be in some kind of death-inducing deliberation about it. But in the more nuanced world of health and society, where context and thoughtfulness are important, then there are definitely urges and impulses that are better left unrealized. Surf the urge, a meditation. 1 to 5 minutes. Meant to be done on the fly, once you get the hang of it, can be done in a few moments. Step one, stop. When you feel the first stirrings of an urge, try to use that feeling as an early warning, a reminder to pause and breathe for a moment. In, out. Breathing out the go-fast tension and urgency. You can still act on the urge. We're just trying to insert the tiniest space between stimulus and response. And this battle, by the way, is practically the whole battle, so I'm not saying it's easy. But it doesn't need to be perfect. You can stop even once you've given in to the urge a little bit, or even a lot. There's still damage control. It's not like stop and go are your only two options. Another thing that's helped me deal with urges, especially the urge to share some half-baked opinion, is something I learned from the Zen teacher Bernie Glassman. When you go into any situation, he said, think, don't know. As in, don't pretend you know what's up and what's really going on. Chill for a bit in the situation. Watching, learning. There's a humility here that is really helpful. It's a kind of natural stop that you can learn to bring with you into all of your life. Next is understand. This just means, oh yeah, I got this urge that's about to pop off. I know what urges are about. They're those things that make me act like a dysregulated idiot and lead me into long chains of self-flagellation and regret. That's the minimum understand move, being conscious enough to know an urge when you feel it. The more in-depth move is to get curious about where you feel the urge in your body, what the sensation feels like, how it moves. Is it in your face, your hands, your chest? Is it prickly or smooth, concentrated or spread out? This is so important. Knowledge is power. If you have an urge that you struggle a lot with in your life, to smoke, to punch, to binge, to blurt, get to know where in your body this drama plays out. You can also start to understand the life cycle of your urges. Generally, our impulses have a bell-shaped curve, which means they come up fast and get real intense, but then they taper off. Once you learn to find the epicenter of the urge, then we ride it. We ride the wave. So the next step, relax. Relax could also be called ride, except for me it feels like I'm riding the urge backwards. It's like you notice the surge that wants to propel you up and forward into doing or saying, but instead you do the opposite. You breathe out and deliberately relax down and back. Take a moment to actually feel this scenario in your imagination. Someone says or does something, and instead of spasming forward like a puppet on a string with your knee-jerk objection or action, instead you pause, breathe out, and settle back through whatever urge has come up, like you and the urge are two ships passing in the night. The action is this settling back into yourself. From the outside, you don't move a millimeter, but from the inside, it's like you've just sat back into a fat armchair. And as you do, you watch the original urge pass through you like a ghost. Last one, freedom. This is about noticing the feeling of the urge passing and you not acting, and taking satisfaction in this. Once again, we're back in equanimity, inside this quality of things moving through you and not fighting with them, the feeling of the energy draining from an urge or an emotion, so you can move towards a reset. The accessible end of this is just noticing you didn't act and taking satisfaction in that. Notice your mindfulness, the mindfulness capable of seeing all this. When you notice and appreciate the mindfulness, you reinforce it. This is what it feels like to be centered, to have autonomy, to be free, or at least more free. Noticing that freedom. Now, whatever's going on out there, it's from this place that you want to respond with the full